It's time for Twig this week in Google. Jeff Jarvis is in studio with us. Stacey Higginbotham on the Skype. We will talk about YouTubers unionizing, the big quarterly results from the big tech companies, and an interesting new strategy for marketing the Pixel phone. It's all coming up next on Twig.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
This is Twig. This Week in Google, episode 519, recorded Wednesday, July 31st, 2019. The Jimmy Hoffa unboxing. This Week in Google is brought to you by Capterra. Find the right tools to make an informed software decision for your business. Visit Capterra's free website at capterra.com/twig. It's time for Twig This Week in Google, the show where we cover any damn thing we want. So I don't want to hear from you. We will talk about Google, but we'll also talk about Facebook, Twitter, and media. And guess who's in studio with us to talk about everything and nothing? It's Jeff Jarvis of BuzzMachine.com. Hi, Jeff.
Yay!
What brings you out here?
The dean and I visited here 5 years ago. She had too much work to do. She has a real job, unlike me. So we 5 years ago, 6 years ago, we came out and we invented a new degree while we were out here. And she came up and she rethought television as a result. And then this time we're doing a reprise. We're visiting Google, Facebook, Twitter.
Built a beautiful studio at CUNY.
We did.
At the J School there. Yeah. What's her name?
Sarah Bartlett.
I wanted to say Sarah Bartlett. Yes. But then I always think, oh no, that's West Wing. But it's not.
Oh, it's not. Yes, yeah.
Jeb's sister, Sarah. Also with us, Stacey Higginbotham.
Yay,
from the
applause
Pacific
for Stacey, too.
Northwest.
Yay, for
Stacey. I'm okay without applause.
Up
it's
in Seattle. It's great to see you. Wonderful to have you, as always.
It is good to be here.
Before we start, I have some footage to show.
Karsten Bondi, our producer.
Yes. Jeff's drive up here.
Oh. No. Now, yes, should we explain that Jeff does not like bridges?
He does not like bridges.
I don't like bridges.
Yeah, we have some rather dramatic
footage. By the way, that's PTSD from 9/11.
It is, yeah.
We have some rather dramatic footage of him running away from a bridge.
Uh-oh.
I was a little freaked out, but then I just made believe it was chewing gum.
That's you.
Jeff Jarvis. Oh, Jeff. Jeff used to be the critic for TV Guide.
Oh, my God. What happened? Now I'm very confused. Was that Howard Stern talking?
Yes.
And then... So somebody is listening to Howard Stern, talking about... This is very meta. Talking about
so
Jeff.
Meta.
And they get in a wreck.
You edited that, right?
They get rear-ended.
No, that was... We just found that.
No, you're kidding me.
We found that.
Found footage.
Jeff, our Jeff... Our Jeff.
All right, rerun. Let's do it again. Do it again.
All right.
For the audio audience, it's in car camera.
Yes.
And he's listening to Howard Stern. That's the audio. And a car comes up from behind and rear ends him.
Jeff Jarvis. Oh, Jeff. Jeff used to be the critic for.
Oh, boom. I think they added the car wheel squeak.
No.
Wow. Flipped him on his side.
Wow.
I hope nobody was hurt in that.
I hope so too.
Horrific
but
accident.
Jesus, what one causes?
I bet someone was.
Yeah, it doesn't look good.
It's all Jeff's fault.
Jeez. The video is from June 16th
of this year.
Was it a Model 3? Because I've been seeing all these Model 3 videos getting.
Why? Because the Model 3s have cameras now that are always recording. So it might have been a Model 3, although it didn't look like a Model 3, but it was hard to tell.
No, it does not
That looks like a pickup truck is what it looks like. It looks like a bed.
So it records out the back?
Yeah, so sometimes people have cameras recording, like for backup. Yeah, it's almost certainly a pickup because that's the problem with pickups. They don't have any weight in the back, and so if you get tapped even, you get tipped.
Yeah, let's be on the Golden Gate. Yep.
Yep. No hazards on the bridge.
Tesla wanted to take me over the. I mean, not Tesla. What am I saying? You have Tesla.
Google.
Waze wanted to take me over the Bay Bridge, and I yelled at the Waze lady. I said, "No, never." And it fell down in an earthquake. No.
But they built it back since then. It's all new.
And it's better. And they use bad bolts. I read those stories.
Yeah. Then there's that other bridge we have, the Richmond Bridge. Which pieces of chunks of it were falling off.
Yeah, just earlier this year.
Yeah. So maybe you're right.
Maybe we should stay away from bridges.
Jesus, can I get a helicopter back to the city, please?
So are YouTubers unionizing? This is a wild story from Vice. The YouTubers Union is not messing around. It's joined forces with Europe's largest trade union to fight for a fairer platform, fighting for the rights of content creators, but also of users. They've joined with IG Metall, Germany's largest union, Europe's largest union.
Which would be like YouTubers being Teamsters.
That's kind of strange.
Which is a funny image, but
it
sure.
Is.
I'm like, yeah, okay. When they joined, they would totally tell where Jimmy Hoffa was buried, though.
So. They tell, but they do a 15 minutes of video before telling.
Oh, well, yeah.
We're going to do the Jimmy Hoffa unboxing.
Yeah. In recent years, this is from the Vice article. In recent Jimmy Hoffa
thank you
unboxing.
For that, Stacey.
I like that.
That was a great setup.
That was
like
awesome.
I think it's not usual that we'll have the title of the show in the first 3 minutes, but I think we actually do. In recent years, YouTube creators have consistently spoken out about changes to the massive platform. They say they're rarely consulted on that affect their ability to make money. YouTube's changed how it handles copyright takedowns. That's actually costing us money. We're not, strictly speaking, YouTube creators, but we put our shows on YouTube, and we do make money on that because we count the downloads on YouTube. And so we've had to make goods in the past for advertisers because, it was a month, right, that one of our shows was taken down for a month. We got it back up because it was an unfair takedown.
Right.
But
it was more than a month. It was 45 days.
45 days.
It was over 45 days, actually.
So that's a good...
45 days to respond to the thing.
So that, that cost us money. YouTube has also demonetized some users. That's its chief punishment for users, it says, are problematic. It's also issued content warnings to some innocuous channels. One of the creators leading the unionization charge, Jörg Sprav, has had his popular slingshot videos removed by YouTube.
Why would that be, do you imagine?
I don't know. It depends what's at the other end of the slingshot, I guess. Sprav traced the origins of the problems leading to this recent move back to changes in YouTube's relationship to advertisers following the 2017 adpocalypse. Major advertisers organized a boycott of YouTube because they didn't want their ads running next to, quote, extremist content, end quote, and demanded that Google implement brand safety controls, which they did. But that costs a lot of content creators significant ad revenue.
So 2 years ago, Hank Green created the Internet Creators Guild.
Yeah.
Which was an effort to do something like that.
But. You know, I'm all for unions. I'm a member of SAG-AFTRA, right. And I've always been a union member. We're not a union shop, but I have nothing against unions. But it seems kind of a slap in the face. YouTube provides free bandwidth, free publicity. I mean, it's a great free platform for content creators.
I was ready to mock it. But you do think that more and more and more, we had a conversation about this week in San Francisco, it's not about jobs, it's about work. And in a freelance gig economy, in a world of Lyft and Uber, and last night I used Caviar while I was watching the debate, to get food brought to me, there is no representation for independent people.
And the gig economy hurts a lot of people. I mean, it's a very hard thing to do. I worry for our kids.
Stacey, have you been in a union?
Have I? Oh, no. I'm from Texas, and B,
we don't have no unions in Texas.
I was like, oh, we're not. But even when I was, I'm trying to think. No, even at my publications, I've never been in a union pub.
Actually, that is one thing that's happening in web publications.
Yes,
they are unionizing. Yeah, because Fortune had half of them were union, and people like me were not.
And print people were union, and the digital people were not. Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, there's very much in the sentiment in this country, anti-union sentiment. Is it? I bet you in the European Union, unions aren't a dirty word.
So named because of it.
I think the point Jeff's making about these platforms, and maybe we don't go to the platforms, but we've historically relied on employers in our country for a social safety net, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that has shifted. And now we don't have a social safety net and we don't have employers. And so we're like, okay. So a lot of the big debates around things like, Medicare for All or universal payer or things like that are because we need something. We don't have anything. And if you look at the gig economy, we're gradually dismantling even the ability of an employer to be your safety net or
so,
to
so
provide.
Stacey, this is one thing that's always puzzled me. In the debate, was going on last night in the election, in the Democratic candidates.
Mm-hmm.
Is that if I were, and I'm not, if I were a Republican company owner, you would think that I would want to get rid of the burden of having to provide health insurance to my employees. Let somebody else do it. Why should that come out of my pocket? Well, why should I have to deal with all that? You know, I would think that, apart from not liking big government, fine. But you think that they want to offload that? I don't understand it just logically.
I don't know because I'm pro health insurance.
I think even business business owners understand that our health system is broken.
So the problem is businesses, big companies who provide health insurance are beholden to stockholders. And stockholders typically want providing health insurance it hurts the bottom line. So I think that's where that's coming from. The loyalty isn't to your employers as a business owner. It's to your shareholders.
That's a good point. But even then, Stacey, you're spending money.
You want the government to do it, right?
You don't want to spend
it.
Yes. Well, and there's a lot of talk about, so if you look at something like, they talk about with companies like Walmart, especially low-paying companies or the pay low wages, what's happening is taxpayers are ultimately subsidizing the high insurance rates of the uninsured that these people have. So what's happening is they're getting kind of a two-for-one in the sense that they're not insuring people, right? And they're not paying taxes. So basically the costs are coming down on municipalities and people who pay taxes into those,
right,
which companies do a little bit, but not as much.
And maybe that's why business owners aren't lobbying for national health care. They just say, well, we're not going to pay.
Yeah.
And so it's up to you. We pay. We have fairly good health insurance for our employees. It's a fairly significant cost.
Mm-hmm.
But I think Lisa, who I can say was a Republican, I don't know if she still is, not anymore, but she's independent now, but still supports single-payer health, government-supported health, because it's, I think, for even... For business owners, it's pretty clear that the health system isn't working. It's inefficient.
Yeah.
Billions of dollars are going into the pockets of insurance companies, not into medical care. And here we are in what should be the country that has the best medical care in the world. And we are not even in the top 20.
And even as a business owner, I was in a fairly large company that had one or two employees who had very sick children, and the rates went kaboom.
Yeah.
So that you're not protected.
That's part of it also, isn't
yeah.
it? Yeah. In fact, that's one of the burdens that we see all the time is the very steep increases year after year after year in the health plans we provide our employees. We've had a couple of years where it went up, double digits, and it was significant increases. And that's without anybody getting sick. I mean, if somebody gets seriously sick in the group, then that's even more of a problem.
So back to the YouTube union. I love the idea of a YouTube picket line where everybody's shooting everybody else on the picket line, right?
But that's why union. That's one reason
video?
People want to unionize, because that is one of the union benefits that's most cherished by people is union health care.
Right, right. But the problem is a union works when you've organized the entire shop.
You have to.
On YouTube, the majority will be with spoilers.
You couldn't even demand a union because even if you had a vote. First of all, who has standing?
Right.
Everybody who ever made a YouTube video, who
right.
has standing?
Right.
This just doesn't make sense. Could it be, but I don't see any reason why creators couldn't join together like the Greens have tried to do and make some sort
difference.
Of guild where they support each other.
Well, but there's always going to be people who don't join, and
right.
they'll be, what is it, scabs? Is that what they are when your union's...
Well, it's a little harsh, but yes.
Okay.
I have a giant inflatable rat that's just waiting to be set up outside of Twit's headquarters.
I imagine, what I now fantasize about is the TikTok union.
What's that?
Well, just,
oh, good Lord.
Yeah.
A bunch of preteens.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, that's why the idea of unionizing YouTube doesn't completely make sense to me.
No.
And yet, I do think YouTube creators have a decent case to present to YouTube. And the only way, the whole point of a union is collective bargaining, right? That if every employee gets together and say, says, we want some concessions from an employer, it's very difficult for the employer to ignore that. You know, you have the threat of a strike, and even if you hire the Pinkertons to beat up the strikers and bring in scabs, it's not a good look.
No.
It's not a good look.
I love that, too. Right. So the YouTubers are out on strike, so there come scab YouTubers who make inferior YouTube videos.
But that's the legitimate threat that these guys have to YouTube, because... And we've always said this. When you're a YouTuber, you are working for free to benefit this giant company.
Yeah.
We don't know. The one thing that I would, if I were a YouTuber, I would want to know is what percentage of the ad revenue am I getting? Google does not even say that. Are they taking 50% of the ad revenue? 70? Apple at least says we take 30%. But Google doesn't even say what the ad revenue is for YouTube and how much the YouTubers get.
Because they negotiate it.
Yeah.
And well, that doesn't mean they couldn't put up a sheet for every YouTube channel and say, this is what we charge and this is what you're getting. They don't want to do that.
No, right.
I understand why they don't. And that's why people form unions, to get that kind of information, mm-hmm. to band together. And I think the most what it's going to take is the top 50 or 100 YouTubers to get together and say,
yeah, okay, PewDiePie and Michelle Phan, the organizing meeting. Yeah.
Yeah.
Could they?
But he's an anarchist, so it's not going to
happen. From an agency? Like, so could there...
Well, that is one thing that's happening, isn't it?
Content
creation agencies.
Yes.
Yeah.
So that at least... That gets them the data they need to argue for better rates and that sort of thing. And then... But, I mean, it does create a middleman instead of a union who's going to negotiate on your behalf. So it's collective bargaining only in the sense that if you're with a powerful enough group who can be like, oh, yeah, well, if you don't take this person, I'm not going to give you this person.
I'm going to come down on the side of the free market here and say, if you want to be on YouTube, you know what the rules are going in. You're getting some real benefit from being on YouTube. We're happy to be on YouTube. We get free distribution.
But I think the Creators Guild is a good idea where there becomes a body. What happened with the newspaper industry, and that's why I've been down talking to all the companies this week, Google did an excellent job of involving newspaper publishers and product people in its new product for subscriptions, for example, changed the relationship that they had, and it gave them a body to talk with. And that wasn't just to fight with or even to negotiate with. It was to create a mechanism to be able to do things together. That would make sense, to have a creators guild to go and talk about ethical standards for creators, ethical standards for Google. That would be interesting.
Then I think we should have a guild of tweeters. The guild of Facebook users. I mean, all of these modern platforms, YouTube, Facebook, and Twitter.
I don't think there's all a professional the content, tweeter.
Well, I'm just pointing out, all the content, all the way they make money by selling ads against content created for free by the users. That is inherently...
But as you said, they get free service back,
well,
Stacey.
Okay, so maybe you create a guild of influencers or a guild of people. I mean, because there's something to the idea that to create rules around ethics and what the type of content you're going to produce, the type of messaging that you're going, you know, however you're going to behave online and how you're going to treat other people and whatnot. And maybe that in influencers is bad because, you know, influencers encompass everything from Instagram people all the way to people who are like creating really cool and popular videos. But something like that does kind of make sense. And creating a professionalizing this category is probably smart. It's already happened in the sense that people have money. And I believe like you could actually do a lot of good for everyone who's involved in this. So think about all those stories about influencers who are like bombarding hotels with requests to like stay there for free, you know, because I'm an influencer with X number.
It's such a disgusting business. And there was a great article in Petapixel by a photographer who was talking about the lavender fields of France, where the farmers have put up a sign saying, please respect our work. Don't trample the lavender. And in front of this sign, he posted, the author of the article posted a picture of dozens of Instagram influencers posing in the lavender. So he says some people come with 12 wardrobe changes so that they can do a fashion shoot in the lavender, picking bunches of lavender for their Instagram shot. He said,
it's a business. Charge them for it.
Yeah. Wow.
Yeah.
They're climbing over the fence. Yes. And this is, I think, more and more of a blight all over the world. I know our photography guy on the radio show, Chris Marquardt, has said something about it. Trey Ratcliffe, great photographer, has actually written a book under the influence about and here's a guy who really created a career on Facebook, Instagram, mm-hmm. and Google Plus, mm-hmm. saying this is horrific what's going on now on Instagram, buying followers, you know, all of these would-be influencers who are swamping the world. There are places where they have signs, no Instagram hashtag, please. It's gotten out of control.
Nah. Okay, relax. Relax.
I do sound like an old guy. Get off of my lavender, you kids.
I don't know if this will... I'm very curious how short-lived this is, or if this is like a new profession in the sense... I mean, marketing has always been around, but like... in this kind of fashion, because I look at like my daughter and her friends, some of them are very into it, but most of them are very skeptical of putting themselves online. Mm-hmm. And their friends who work hard at this, they're not shy about saying how hard they work at it. So it's obviously a very small group of people. So I'd be curious to hear how other, you know, 10-year-olds and 15-year-olds are viewing this as a career. It's
everybody,
hard work.
You remember, I mean, for a while everybody said, well, I'm going to become an NBA star, I don't need to study.
I was in the 90s or late 80s, I wanted to be a supermodel for a hot
right.
second.
Well, who wouldn't?
But,
as well, you should have been.
So Paul Rafer, the photographer, wrote this in Petapixel: photographers, Instagrammers, stop being so damn selfish and disrespectful. And here's the picture of the fields in the south of France, the lavender fields in Provence. Mm. Respect our work, please. And all the photographers trampling into the lavender fields. And of course, if you look for the hashtag, what did he say the hashtag was? Hashtag lavender, I guess. You will see all of these pictures. You know, and all of these people, they damaged the land, they'd stolen the owner's products, they'd ruined the fields. Here it is. Yeah, hashtag lavender. 4.9 million hashtag lavender posts. And look at these. I mean, you know, fashion shoots in the lavender.
Let's be clear here. The problem here is bozos, not technology.
Absolutely. But these bozos were not as prevalent until technology empowered them.
There's always been motives for bozo-ishness.
This is what I come up with, though, every single time. You're right. For instance, public records are stored at the county courthouse. They always have been. And if somebody wants to, they can go to the county courthouse and find out where you live. But as soon as you added technology, databases, and the internet to this, anybody can go to a website like Spokio and find out where anybody in the world lives. And that's the problem. Technology is such a powerful tool that can amplify bozos. And
as well as good things.
I will say that this kind of platform has, like the launch of Instagram and Snapchat, has created an audience and an incentive that incentivizes this behavior. An audience for it and an incentive that wasn't there prior. So, and I don't think there are people who wake up and are born with this desire to trample people's fields and disrespect their property. But I do think there are people who are maybe a little more selfish and not thinking about others, or don't realize the impact of their actions. And what happens is these platforms draw attention to a single place, and then you get a bunch of people who behave that same way and have that same sense of entitlement, and then voila.
We're negotiating norms around that. Enough people have to scold the people on those right. photos and say, "What did you do?
Stop it! Knock it off!"
Yeah,
I have to say this comes across a little bit as a curmudgeonly photographer who wishes he had it to himself again. Here's a picture from Wanaka, Lake Wanaka in New Zealand, that he took 6 years ago of a little tree that's out there in the lake, and he says, "Nowadays, this is what it looks like." With thousands of photographers, wedding photographers coming out and swamping the lake. And here's even one guy who decided he wanted to climb up into the tree and sit there so nobody could get that shot. So, yeah, he kind of wishes it were back to this, you know, lone tree and him. But that's also a point of view of privilege.
It's a privilege, yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
So let me try this out on you, since you both like to criticize the Valley, and I've been there this week.
You've been in the Valley.
I've been in the Valley. I heard from a lot of people who, let me start here. When I lived in San Francisco, when I lived here in my day, I left, I hate to admit this, in 1981, so long before Silicon Valley was Silicon Valley. It was a place people, San Francisco was a place people adored. They were passionate about. They loved it. They cared about it. It was a special place. What I've heard all this week from people in technology and elsewhere is nobody likes San Francisco. Everybody's fed up with San Francisco.
That's very sad because it was one of the great cities.
It was. And it's not just San Francisco, of course. It's the whole thing. Now, when I lived there, you looked down on the peninsula, what is now Silicon Valley, and thought no one would want to die being
That's
there.
That's the Nouveau Riche down there.
Well, no, it wasn't the Nouveau Riche. It was the American Tacky.
Yeah.
I did a column.
Tacky has his, right?
I did a column for the Examiner once where I did a census of every single fast food and junk food brand on the entirety of El Camino Real. All
Der
the way up and down.
Schnitzel.
All of them.
Carl's Jr.
My favorite
Wendy's.
One was Eat My Quiche.
Eat My Quiche.
But that was how people envisioned the peninsula, was that it was the strip mall that was taking over America, and now that strip mall is in charge of the world. And so it's really fascinating to me. And I also talked to a lot of people about philanthropy, because we're a school and we're out here and we're going to beg for money. And people say, no, nobody here gives any money. No, not going to happen, no. I mean, yeah, you got Benioff, and yeah, you got Zuckerberg, but no, nobody gives any money. And somebody said to me that they thought that the technology rich folk think that angel investing in a company is like charity.
That's our charity.
Yep. And that's their thing they're starting.
We're
right.
Funding innovation.
Bingo. And so you have this it's worse than ennui. It's a bit of self-hatred springing up from the entire Bay Area, which is just so strange to me. You know, when I lived here, you had these society mockers, Pat Montandon, Cyril Magnin.
Oh, yeah.
Right? And they would say, darling, don't we need a symphony in San Francisco?
Yeah.
Let's raise money for the symphony. And then you have a huge symphony hall gets built, right? People used to get money here.
The old patronage system.
They really did. And now that doesn't exist in San Francisco. And now people are worried
patrons
about...
Patrons of the arts. Is Silicon Valley not patrons of the arts? There's
no.
A San Jose Symphony, isn't there?
Hardly. Nothing. So it is interesting to say,
bros.
What is the culture
of...
Not just the Valley itself, but the Valley in San Francisco and all that now.
I have to think this isn't permanent, that this is just a blip. The go-go, you know, boom nature of the boom. Did you ever watch Deadwood about the gold rush in South Dakota?
Yeah, well, that's,
those people were really
that's your kind of Gutenberg
dicks.
Moment here. Yeah, yeah.
there were no laws. They were, you know, it was crazy. But that was the nature of the boom. I'm sure Deadwood, South Dakota is not lawless anymore.
It's boring.
It's probably fairly boring.
Sure,
yeah.
They don't have a symphony.
But they don't have a symphony. They didn't have a symphony then either.
So, Stacey, what about, since you went from Austin, did Austin have a touch of that?
Austin was a little different because it doesn't have a lot of super rich people. So I grew up in Houston where we had huge patronage
that
of the arts, right?
The oil folks, right?
The oil folks, they just give money all the time. Right.
Because they're guilty.
They're guilty. And
I think it's an older tradition. I think it's the George Bush kind of patrician tradition of patronage.
Well, and I was going to say new money trying to impress old money. I mean, Houston was very much a
nothing wrong with that.
We are just as good as New York or God help us, Dallas. We're better than Dallas.
We're just as good as Dallas.
So we need our own TV show.
That's my motto. Houston. Ta 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 ta.
So in Austin, it was for the longest time, it was real estate money, and there was donations, but they weren't as big because they just didn't have quite as much money. And then when the tech guys came, Michael Dell didn't donate any money for a really long time. No, only now has Dell started donating money. He was very stingy. And then other than that, there weren't a lot of startup. There were a lot of startup companies, but very few ever made it big, made it public, that sort of thing.
John Thornton is a Austin.
Oh
Ventures.
My God, that man is such a friggin' jerk. But he is philanthropic.
Oh,
he is a small-minded,
Oh my!
So now that you're in Seattle, is it different there? Seattle has a lot of public works. Paul Allen built that beautiful museum. I think you know he bought Seahawks
well,
when
Gates.
Gates is having an Andrew Carnegie moment. Yes. Gates was the rapacious billionaire. What did they call them? The Rockefellers and the Carnegies. They called them the robber barons. Gates was a robber baron until after he retired. Well, actually, it was when he married his wife, Melinda Gates. He started giving to charity. And then he had kind of a moment like Andrew Carnegie, the steel baron, who was Terry. Talk about bringing in the Pinkertons to bust the union. He was famous for this. But in his later in life, I think he thought, I want to go to heaven. So he built beautiful free public libraries all over the country. We have one in Petaluma. And I feel like Bill Gates is our Andrew Carnegie. He's making up for his sins.
And I think for any executive, maybe it's just in the tech world, I don't know. But you get to a certain level. At first, you're scrapping by, and you still feel scrappy. You don't know that you're successful yet, right? Yeah. And then at that point in time, you become evil, right? I think what happens is you're still fighting and scrapping, and you don't know if you're gonna make it still, even though everyone else is like, "Okay, buddy, you've made it."
look at Steve Jobs, who was famously stingy with charity. Mm-hmm. Apple mm-hmm. never did mm-hmm. any of that. Mm-hmm. He passed away before he had a chance to have his Andrew Carnegie moment.
And his widow is doing amazing
Laureen
things.
Laureen is giving away tons of money.
Bought Atlantic Magazine. It's not just giving away money. It's also supporting for-profit efforts that are good for society, like the Atlantic.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's her Emerson Collective that's doing all that investing. Yeah, good for Laureen Jobs. She's really a remarkable person. But she doesn't see, that's the difference. Maybe wives are important for this equation because
men are jerks. greedy, selfish jerks.
But that's us. But neither Laureen Jobs nor Melinda Gates had to scrap their way up to the top and create the company that made all that money. And so maybe they don't have that same Travis Kalanick kind of mentality of, I'm the underdog, I got to fight every step of the way. I don't have time for charity. Bill Gates famously said, I'm not going to give away any money until I can do it right, until I have the time to use my money wisely. And look, and actually, that was a pretty good maxim. Mark Zuckerberg, how much did he give Newark that was just thrown away, basically, because it was inappropriate giving? It was a waste of money.
I think you also have Mackenzie Bezos is already starting to be philanthropic.
Yeah.
Considering she has a large amount of money.
Does Jeff Bezos have a big philanthropy arm? Is there a Bezos Family Foundation?
I think he's starting to invest in things, but...
Jeff's charity, this is very similar, actually, is going to Mars.
Blue Origin,
it's going to Mars. We screwed up this planet, so I'll tell you what I'm going to do as my charity. I'm going to colonize Mars so we have somewhere, a plan B.
He also saved the Washington Post.
He did save the Washington Post. Okay, there's some credit there.
He launched a $2 billion fund for homeless families.
All right.
And education.
So Bezos is doing good
with his
stuff.
But that's pretty recent. And
it is very
I
recent.
Think part of that is part of this, like, oh, now I need to give. At a certain point in time, you have to give.
Well, I think this is a timely moment to mention how much money these guys are making, because it is the quarterly report time of year. Facebook, its second 1.5 billion daily active users in June 2019. That's an 8% increase. So all you people quitting Facebook, you didn't make a dent. Monthly active users, 2.41 billion, also an 8% increase. But here's the number that I think is important. Mobile advertising revenue, 94% of Facebook's advertising revenue came from mobile. That's up from 91%.
And when did they make the, we got to go mobile pitch?
That was a couple of years, 3 years. I remember when Facebook went public, the real question on everybody's mind was, can Facebook survive? Boy, were we dumb. Can Facebook survive in a mobile world? All their revenue is desktop. 28% increase year over year in advertising. 36% in other fees and payments. So they had a 28% bump in revenue. Costs went up, though, 66%. That's a pretty big jump in costs. They must be doing a lot of R&D and a lot of investment. Income from operations was down as a result, 21%. Their operating margin was down from 44%. That's a nice margin. To 27%, which is actually lower than Apple. And their effective tax rate, they don't mention what it was last year. Probably because it was zero. Their effective tax rate for this quarter was 46%. So that probably includes the $5 billion fine from the FTC.
Can you count that as a tax?
I don't know. Let's see. No. I see an asterisk.
A fine? Yeah. That's an extraordinary expense. Event.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
It's an
includes
expense
an additional $2 billion in legal expenses related to the FTC's settlement and a $1.1 billion income tax expense due to developments in Altera Corp versus Commissioner.
Wait a second. So it cost $2 billion in lawyers they to pay $5 billion.
They spent $2 billion in legal fees.
Oh, that's a great return then.
If you include Facebook, Instagram, WhatsApp, and Messenger, their family of services, 2.1 billion daily active users.
So I was down in both Menlo Park and Mountain View this last week. And the last time I was at Facebook, there were building 20 was done. There's the old campus, then across the street is building 20, which is the one that has the famous walk on top and all that.
Oh,
right?
Yeah, yeah.
Now building 21 is done, and it's like doubles it. And now they're quadrupling that down the road. I think from end to end, it looks like it's going to be at least a mile of kind of one continuous building where they're all walking to the cafeteria all the time. Back
well,
and
that's
forth,
good for
back
you.
Back and forth.
That's good for you.
And then down in Mountain View, have you seen the construction of the new Google buildings down there, the tents? Oh, do we have any pictures of that?
Yeah, we do.
Oh,
yeah.
It's unbelievable. Yeah. It's just these gigantic tent-like structures under which will appear buildings.
The growth like of Facebook, these companies. They want to make these kind of almost indoor-outdoor spaces.
But they're just amazing, that the symbol of that. But yet, there's no branding on them anywhere.
Google now has more cash than Apple.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. Apple had half the cash in the world.
Go pour it.
Yeah. Well, partly she's that's because Apple repatriated and rebought stock with it. So Apple's
but Google's going to do a...
Nest egg is down to $102 billion. It was all the way up to 163.
Is that before the stock buyback?
I don't know. Alphabet's financial reserves are now 117... Financial reserves. In other words, money in their pocket. $117 billion. That's a $20 billion increase over the last couple of years.
Is that short term? Is that cash?
It's the corporate liquidity
equivalents.
Yeah, they are the top of the corporate liquidity rankings.
Dang.
That's a lot. And that's even after the €8.2 billion fine. That's how much they've paid in the last couple of years to the EU.
So, Alphabet bought back $3.6 billion of stock in the second quarter.
So it was even after that.
Wow. The company's new $25 billion buyback authorization.
Yeah.
So look at this sort of thing in the context of, okay, let's look at their contractors versus their employees. Look at a company like Verizon, or actually AT&T, which is more unionized than Verizon, and think about, you know, how that math ends up working. So if you look at margins and profits on AT&T, and not that they're a wonderful company that's just not screwing anyone over anywhere, but they do have financial obligations they can't worm their way out of. And this is shareholders that are getting this money, the stock buybacks, et cetera.
So good for shareholders. So it's interesting. Alphabet, well, Apple spent $122 billion over the last 18 months buying back stock.
Oof.
And including dividends. Google, $1.7 billion a quarter, much less. According to the Financial Times, in that time, Google has handed out more new shares in the form of employee stock benefits than it's bought back. Now, shareholders don't like that because that actually does not help Cheryl. Yeah. It dilutes them. But
they're not using this cash to invest in.
They must see this as a necessary thing to keep their.
They don't know what to do with the cash. It shows a lack of a. This is unfair, but I'll be unfair because, hey, it's only a podcast. it shows a lack of imagination.
Yeah.
Right? If you've got this cash.
I think they just have so much. I mean, that is a lot of cash.
Yeah.
And it's kind of this. I mean, think about it like the Bill Gates problem. They actually have a fiduciary responsibility to do something good or useful for their bottom line with it, right? Yeah.
So well, that's exactly what they think they're doing. Ruth Porat, the CFO, said the increase in stock repurchase, which is now $25 billion to a stock buyback program, did not reflect any change in Alphabet's financial priorities. Alphabet's two top goals, to your point, Stacey, were unchanged: to invest in the long-term growth of its existing businesses and to support acquisitions. That's one thing Google does more than Apple.
Mm-hmm.
Apple doesn't like acquisitions. And I don't blame them because acquisitions are challenging for a company.
But didn't someone do a story about how Apple has been making way more acquisitions?
Maybe lately.
I mean, maybe they did just buy Intel's chip business for $1 billion.
That's a big one, $1 billion. And 2,000 Intel employees are coming over. But that's historically difficult for a company. If you look at the history of acquisitions in the tech sector, it's almost an unbroken chain of failures and misery, because it's hard to, when HP bought HP bought? I've forgotten now. Was it Gateway? That was that big
K-Pro, Compaq, back in the day.
Compaq. HP bought Compaq. Integrating those two teams was a nightmare and never really went very well. When Time Warner.
Those are big
acquisitions.
Tie two bricks together and they're still going to sink kind of deals. Yeah. But you look at Apple.
Apple's doing it smart. I agree with you.
They're acquirers
as much as anything else.
Yeah, their Wikipedia page shows that they have started acquiring many more companies in the last 5 years. Most of those companies are small. The acquisitions, not actually.
They're really hiring. They're hiring great engineering teams. They're buying, perhaps buying intellectual property, but they're not trying to buy companies.
They actually in this last year. So there's Intel smartphone modem business.
That's a big one.
They bought Shazam. That was
such a big one.
But
Beats was their last big acquisition.
$100 million. It was a $400 million deal. That's not insignificant.
But how many employees did they acquire?
Yeah,
I don't know how many employees.
I think they probably got the technology more than anything else. Yeah.
And they've done a lot of semiconductor deals, believe it or not.
Makes sense because they're trying to build a semiconductor business. That's why the Intel acquisition makes sense. They want to build their own silicon.
That makes no sense. That's just like that's a weird thing. But I was going to say most of their chip deals have actually been relatively small tuck-ins with cool technology. And what they've done is they've hired people, the engineering leads they hired the former Papermaster, I can't think of his first name, who was their head of silicon when they wanted to design their own chip. So what they've actually done is find really small chip companies that offer maybe it's a weird networking fabric, maybe it's an optimization scheme. And then they've actually hired someone well-known in the chip industry to pull that together with, ARM silicon or whatever. That's why this Intel deal is so weird and dumb. It's because Intel has not done a great job with their modem business, one. So Apple doesn't buy technology that's bad. It buys technology that's just not known yet. So, yeah. That's on that topic.
That'll be interesting to watch that because there were some stories that Intel felt like that was a fire sale, that $1 billion was not nearly enough for the thousands of patents and the 2,000
employees. Who else was going to buy it?
But that's the problem. There was no one else out there who had anywhere near that kind of money. And only Apple, this is all about Apple getting out from under Qualcomm. And remember, Apple has paid $1 billion to Qualcomm for licenses over the last couple of years. So $1 billion to get out from under Qualcomm maybe is a bargain if they can get out from under them. That's the question. I think is that why you're saying it's not a great acquisition? Because how good was Intel's 5G modem anyway?
Exactly.
It seemed like Intel was struggling to make it.
It was not a good product. So right. Now what I would expect to see then is now that once Apple assesses all of this and takes a look, what I imagine will happen is it will either find something to fill in the gaps in Intel's technology.
Yeah.
And I don't know enough about it.
Which includes, by the way, licenses from Qualcomm, of all things.
Yeah. And then, or it will hire some sort of Qualcomm, they have Qualcomm people there, but hire someone in charge of like building 5G chips that's really right. well known in the industry and bring them in.
This, it fits in, and maybe it is a bad acquisition, but it fits in with Apple's general desire to vertically integrate the entire process, hardware and software. They'd like to make everything. Because if they make everything, they've been... One of the problems Apple's had over the last few years is that Intel has not been able to deliver with CPUs or modem chips or anything else, and it's held Apple's product line back.
So, Stacey, where's most of the fabbing done for that the Intel stuff that Apple bought? U.S. or foreign?
I'm going to guess it's either TSMC or,
in Taiwan. Intel's,
yeah.
I can give you a list of Intel's fab locations.
I just wonder about
Intel. Chandler, Arizona.
Tariffs and all that.
Rancho Rio.
No, those aren't the modem chips. Those aren't the modem chips.
Oh.
Those are the CPUs. So I think the modem chips are fabless, but I don't know that for sure. Okay, if you give me time, I will look
at it.
That would make sense. That's where you'd have TSMC and others.
Right. And I can't think of the other one that I'm thinking of. TSMC and...
Micron?
No, that's memory.
Global Foundries?
Global Foundries is the old AMD one. They do memory mostly, I think. It's
UMC?
UMC is the other one, and then there's an SM one. Anyway, okay, just ignore me. Ignore me.
STM?
Well, this is Infineon's stuff. Actually, so I'm trying to remember
I'm giving you these names from a spreadsheet of 73 rows of Intel chip foundries.
Yeah.
And by the way, they are all over the world. So
yeah,
I know Hillsboro, Oregon is a big place for the CPUs. Mm-hmm. They make some in Israel, the microprocessors. Make a lot of RAM in Singapore, the U.S., Japan. They have a foundry
in
Germany. So they're all over the world. It's really interesting.
Those global foundry ones are memory. Yeah, I would look at the TSMCs in that place. Yeah. But
yeah, that's Taiwan. And then there's a UMC, which is in China. Wow. France. SMIC is Beijing and Shanghai, Tianjin and Shenzhen. How did we get into this? I don't know.
We fell into a
foundry hole. Oh, yeah. Did we do Google's financials yet? I can't even remember. No. Alphabet. No, we started with their cash pile. What we didn't talk about is their revenues. And where have I put that? Where have I stuck that?
I don't think that made it onto the rundown.
I believe they announced their Q2 earnings. Here's a story from Quartz. Google's future beyond advertising is starting to become clear. Alphabet's cash cow has always been Google, and Google's largest revenue driver has always been by far advertising. July 25th, Alphabet reported its second quarter earnings, $32.6 billion in revenue from Google's ad business. That's a 16% increase. But traffic acquisition costs went up also 12%. In fact, traffic acquisition costs are 22% of Google's ad revenue. So that's a cause perhaps for concern. I'm not a Wall Street analyst, so I don't really know what this means. Revenue from ads dwarfs everything else. If you look at this graph.
What else are they going to do?
Yeah. Other revenues is blue. Purple is ad revenue. Other revenues is tiny. And you can't even see other bets, which is a tiny little sliver below that. But ad revenue is doing very, very well. It's still a good business for Google, right?
It's still a good business, but it's not growing. So you look at that and you say, is it kind of plateauing? And then I would also, the other thing to look at there are margins. How are the margins doing? Are they shrinking?
Wall Street liked it. Their stock went up was bumped quite a bit, as I remember.
I think that just as advertising is challenged in media, it's also challenged in the platforms. And the form of advertising is not forever. So I think...
Well, that's Google where and, other and, bets and is Facebook, really important, right?
Yeah, Google and Facebook are vulnerable to, you know, the ad industry itself is suffering. Being an agency right now is no fun.
Other bets, which includes Waymo, the health sciences, Verily, their internet, these are all money losers. Other bets lost almost $1 billion. That's an increase of 35%, generating a mere $162 million in revenue. Over the last 8 quarters, over the last 2 years, Other Bets has lost $6.6 billion. So I don't know what this court's headline really means. It doesn't sound like anything but ads are making money for,
pretty much true.
For Google. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Maybe, okay, so Nest cameras, Pixel phones.
Yeah, their hardware is
Play Store revenues,
not gigantic,
Google Cloud
but it
services.
Is really coming up.
Company posted $4.25 billion for that business line compared to $6.2 billion. Last year was $4.25 billion. This year it was 40% higher. So, yes, it is coming up. $6.2 billion in its hardware division.
And when they come up with a new Chromebook Pixel, services. I'm sure it'll go up another $1 billion. When are you going to do that, guys? Huh?
Yeah.
When? Google has was it last week? Neither of you were here last week, and we had a whole thing on Chromebooks.
Of course, you did. Had Dr. Chromebook, and the king of Chromebooks.
What did Kevin Toefel say? And Jason Howell loves his Chromebook, too. Yeah.
Yeah. I don't remember. I ignore it when it comes to Chromebooks. I'm sorry.
I knew Jeff, I knew enough
to be like, oh, Jeff would be so excited. They were talking about LTE on Chromebooks, which I know is your thing.
Here's an interesting change in strategy from Google. They're kind of following the OnePlus marketing model. They're starting to just talk about their phones, even though the Pixel 4 won't be out till later this fall. They're already releasing information about the Pixel 4. This is a Google blog post. As we shared last month, Pixel 4 is in the works. Today, we're giving you an early look at the technology behind two new features. I like this.
I do, too.
Instead of doing the Apple, oh, you can't know. It's all going to be a surprise. Google's saying, let's talk about it. Maybe you'll be more interested in what we've got.
And get some excitement built up.
Motion Sense. For the past 5 years, the Advanced Technology and Projects teams, ATAP, has been working on solely... S-O-L-I. That's a motion sensor radar. We've got a miniature version at the top of the Pixel 4. It's not in a notch, by the way. The Pixel 4 will not have a notch. It's just going to have a big bezel up at the top. Hallelujah. It senses small motions around the phone, combining unique software algorithms with advanced hardware sensor to recognize gestures.
So let's figure out where this is going to go next. Because I figure that basically what's going to happen is people are going to look stupid in a whole new way.
They're going to be waving at their phone to skip songs.
Just stop. We talked about this today.
Silence
Kevin
phone
and I.
Calls.
No, this is not for that. This is,
what is
for
this
everything
down?
Else.
Semaphore on your phone.
This is for, imagine yourself in front of your Google Nest Hub, whatever the heck it is, the smart display. You're moving through your recipe that you're working on. You're moving through your song.
Oh, that's a
so you don't
good
have
idea.
To say, yeah. Hey, Google, do this. Oh, sorry, everyone. I'm so sorry. and then, so that's one. Two, think about it in your car. And so where we're going to see this, they're putting this on phones as a test. They're also doing it. I had said it was for economies of scale, but no one actually buys Pixels. So they're just doing it to give developers access to it in a
it
format.
It will be available in Android. So it is, as the Pixel really should be, a reference design for what other phone manufacturers might be
doing. When Soli first came out, I was excited about it, and I still am. This is interesting for robotic vision. So for robots, being able to, understand. So the ultrasonic sensor, the radar sensor that's in there, gives it fine-grained understanding of movement, which means it can understand where a person is in space much better than using cameras. And it's not...
I love it. Look, we're looking for new user interfaces. Voice is one. Yes.
Right.
Gestures makes a lot of sense. Shall I introduce the conspiracy theory at this point?
Sure.
The other thing will be very useful for Google... is it's another kind of camera. And
it's,
so,
it's not a camera.
No, it's another kind of camera. It's radar.
It's pulling in data about where a person is in space, but it's actually much less granular and fine grained than.
But think about it. It can be used for identification as well. One of the things Google has already pioneered is gate recognition. I think that Google has interests. Cameras doesn't just have to be a visual picture of what's around you. I think a radar of what's around you might be of equal interest to Google. And the more sensors they have on that phone, the better they can gather information. They also say they're going to add face unlock, which, of course, Apple pioneered here. They say the Pixel 4 will proactively unlock faces even if you don't lift your phone. If the face unlock sensors and algorithms recognize you, the phone will open the minute you pick it up. It's already recognized you. It just hasn't unlocked until you tell the phone, I want to use you. Face unlock works in almost any orientation, even if it's upside down. And you can use it for secure payments and app authentication, too. This is a little bit of let's do what Apple's
so doing. Benedict Evans, who's a brilliant analyst at Andreessen Horowitz, wrote a piece, I just put it in the rundown, this month, arguing that talking about computers that can see.
Yeah.
That how a huge number of cameras that are being produced are not produced to make anything for us human beings to look at.
I agree.
At, right?
Yes.
I think he's right.
And that's where the notion of vision goes. It's a lot of Stacey's world, right, Stacey?
Yes. And I've, in the last 2 or 3 years, I think I've written his article several times.
Yeah.
But yes. And this type of technology, I know just a couple. Probably a few months ago, I wrote about radar and Project Soli and other sensor efforts that use radar. This is going to be super popular for aging in place. People are already using it to measure falls.
There's a good use. Yeah.
Yep.
There's the conspiracy theory. Yes. But this is for most people way less intrusive because, and this has always been the case. People worry about images of themselves that are viewable by other people online and searchable, right? We worry about cameras for that reason. People don't think about metadata that can equally understand that when a computer knows that, you know, I am doing something embarrassing, it doesn't bother me because it's a computer. As long as the computer, and people don't think about the fact that the computer can say, oh, this set of metadata means Stacey's picking her nose right now. You know, as long as that's not visually out there on the internet, I don't care.
What happens in Intel stays in Intel. Yeah.
I would submit that that's a typical human-centric point of view, but not a very informed point of
which
view.
Which is what Stacey's saying.
It's not, but that's what I'm saying. I'm saying that people think that's great, but what's really happening is that metadata about my falls or me picking my nose or whatever, that is going to be turned into Stacey picks her nose.
Right.
Let's market her some, I don't know what products nose pickers have.
The information is also face recognition. Radar makes, in fact, Apple has basically that kind of 3D sensing built into its iPhone Face ID. Face recognition with a 2D still image isn't as good as 3D images.
They don't use radar. Is it a time of flight depth sensor? Time of flight?
It is not.
Time of flight.
No,
what is
like LiDAR?
What type of...
It's not LiDAR.
There are three...
It's not LiDAR because they're thinking of adding LiDAR in 2020.
Apple bought an Israeli company called PrimeSense that developed this initially for Microsoft's Kinect. And it's the same technology in the Apple iPhone, I should point out, can tell your heart rate.
Right.
So with the Kinect, for instance, when you're exercising... Microsoft stopped selling it for a reason I don't fully understand.
But there are three different technologies.
They can tell if you're exercising hard enough because your heart rate at distance is not fast enough. This kind of technology is very useful.
Yes, but my quibble with you is there are three different types of technologies that allow for depth perception.
Radar
is one of them, but I don't think that's the one that Apple's using. Sorry.
No, but
I'm arguing with you on a purely tech basis.
So Apple... And in fact, Apple even demonstrated this when they introduced Face ID. It sends out an infrared light, which they bounce off your face, which detects the contours of your face. So it's not technically time of flight, but it's very similar to that kind of
3D. Google's face recognition is supposed to be different. The story's about
said because they didn't have the patent.
but it's supposed to be
Apple
better,
owns PrimeSense.
How does it?
Well, they just have to do something different.
Because they're saying you don't even have to pick it up to your face. It can do it from different angles and upside down.
Yeah, and this was, you know, Apple has had to struggle a little bit when it first came out with Face ID at doing it at different, you know, and if it's the camera's rotated.
I'm dreading it.
But they have that. They've mastered that. That it does it now.
I'm dreading it.
Well, I want to point out that it's, you know, there's some value to it for unlocking or sensing or gestures, but I wouldn't be, and you know, you got to remember how Google thinks about this. They're not rubbing their hands gleefully saying, and while we're doing that, we can also sense your heart rate and all these other things. They think of this all as a general benefit. We will know more about you and we can deliver more services as a result. But I should point out, as you have, Stacey, that it is much more information than a 2D picture can give you. And can be used in a variety of ways, and we don't yet know what kinds of ways. Google did point out that just like Apple, they're going to store all that face recognition in a secure enclave chip within the Pixel 4, so it won't be sent
right. It will
to
be
Google.
Local, yeah, which is exciting. Local.
Yeah, so that's good news. What is important also to point out, and we always point this out with Apple, is they may store the raw data of your fingerprint or your Face ID on the phone and never send it to Apple, but they absolutely send out the processed information later that they know. So and they even admit to this. Yeah, we don't have your fingerprint, but we know the information that generates. And I think that Google would do the same thing for a variety of reasons.
Oh, here. I found a paper. For the super nerds, I'm going to put it in the chat. Here is the SIGGRAPH paper from 2017 on how Soli works.
Oh, cool.
There you go.
Thank you.
And I am reading it right now to figure this out.
Well, it's all right. You don't have to do it right now.
I have to know.
It's okay.
I'm like, this is how I know this stuff. I read lots of papers.
Yeah, I bet you do. Yeah.
Stacey, let me ask you about that for a second. How many do you have to subscribe to a lot of academic journal databases?
I subscribe
databases?
To no academic journals. What I do is I pay attention for like Hot Chips or SIGGRAPH, which just happened. And a lot of companies, if I talk to them, they'll just send me the papers, their white papers. Because, I mean, it's really rare that they're interviewing a journalist and the journalist gets so excited about what they're doing that they're like, can I see your white paper? Can I see your research? And then I go on Archive, which is like my favorite place ever. But that's for AI research more than chip research.
Got it.
Let's see. Google is stopping people on the street and giving them $5.
Just relax. It's okay.
They say to perfect their Pixel 4 Face ID feature, because of course you need the data before you can make Face ID work reliably. Google has said that. It was initially reported by Chris Matizic in ZDNet. He said, I think he was in Washington Square Park in the city. Hi, I work for Google, somebody said, and we're collecting data to improve the next generation of face recognition of facial recognition phone unlocking. You need to hold the phone in selfie mode in front of your face, moving it around to analyze every feature of your appearance, and then we'll give you a $5 Amazon or Starbucks gift card.
So they're disclosing. It's fine. Yeah. They're saying what's what. It's all right.
And companies need to do this.
Yeah. They could do it surreptitiously. They could just put a camera out and do it. But
well, that wouldn't get them the measurements they need.
Well, five or six cameras.
Yeah.
Well, here's what they could do. They could put out an app saying, hey, yes, if you scan your face for us, we'll tell you what you look like when you'll be 20 years old.
Who would ever do that? Google
did this with their art thing.
Yeah, remember that? Yeah.
Yeah.
Microsoft's done it too, but Microsoft did the aging thing. When it comes to the data the company's already gathered from the compensated volunteers, Google is allowing them to decide what ultimately happens to it. Although face samples inherently can't be anonymous, says Google, each participant is assigned an abstract identity number. We separately keep each participant's email address in order to remove data upon request. That's probably a GDPR requirement. Participants previously agreed to allow Google to keep... They should call themselves Doodle. Google to keep their face data for 5 years. Now they're cutting it down after the publicity to 18 months.
Once they've analyzed, they don't need it.
Yeah, they don't need it. The Pixel 4 will not send your data to Google for its face recognition to work. should reiterate that.
Good. You're calm today. This is good.
I'm always calm.
I think, is it weird? Maybe Jeff has a calming influence on you?
I'm not any different than I always am.
Or do you have a calming influence on Jeff?
Exactly the same.
Even Jeff seems calm.
You just wait.
Let's talk about Section 203. No.
Yeah, let's not rev him up. Actually, let's talk about the quality. Oh, medium is down. Well, I'll have to talk to the author about what's wrong with tech journalism.
So there was, is it down? There was a very good paper that I saw presented at an academic conference in Medium. Yeah, it's,
it came back up. Okay.
By Axel Bruns, who's an academic at the University of Queensland. And he pokes holes, rather considerable, gigantic wormhole holes, in the notions and metaphors of the, it's on Buzz Machine.
Okay. Your blog is never down.
Don't jinx me. In the idea of the filter bubble and the echo chamber. And does a very good literature read, going through all the literature that says, folks, it doesn't really exist, but these metaphors are being used, and the metaphors are not at all defined, so we don't have any mechanism to argue about it or measure it or understand what this impact is.
So define, before we go too much farther, what is commonly believed to be the echo chamber in the filter bubble?
They become almost synonymous.
Eli Pariser used the term filter.
Eli Pariser argued that filter bubble is that if you went into search, and that you and I would get
because search is, and the way Google does it anyway, is modified based on your previous searches. You're going to tend to get eventually over time the same results.
That was the argument, though Axel Bruns points to research that says that wasn't the case, except for within a nation you had similar search results, but maybe even within
a zip code.
No.
It has to be as big as a nation.
Yeah, that there you have different languages and so on, so you have different search. But in Google Search and Google News, this research showed, because it's actual research. So this sent me on to an argument, and I'm a fake academic. I am no academic. I'm just a journalism teacher. But among the real academics who are doing the kind of papers that Stacey reads that really matter, there's a standard and discipline of evidence. And we don't have that in journalism. And I end up ranting about the quality of technology journalism. It went from full utopian to full dystopian, and things like echo chamber and filter bubble bubble up to become just presumed this exists,
right,
without any effort to even do a literature search and see what exists in the evidence. And then regulation and legislation is going to pop out of that. And we're just irresponsible in my field. So I complained about that. I thought I'd get a lot of crap from people like you, but so far I haven't. And I think we have a problem in the tech journalism world that we haven't really dealt with. But it's not just tech journalism; it's all of journalism.
It's
right?
It's humans.
We should be better.
That's because
humans, better journalism, of course.
No, it's okay. We have to. More data is always good, but the challenge with journalism, and you can call it a filter bubble, you can call it whatever you want, is we are writing stories for people. And people are story and narrative oriented. And Jeff, you have some academic book that talks about this.
Yes. How History Gets Things Wrong, the Neuroscience of Our Addiction to Stories.
Yes.
Stacey, that doesn't mean the story has to be factless.
Journalists do look for facts. We just look for facts in the context in which we have today, which is driven by a narrative. I mean, how do you find your stories? I tell you how. I mean, I find my stories because people talk to me about things they've noticed.
But I know, Stacey, I know that you're a good journalist and responsible journalist, attempt to escape the confines of your preconceived notions when you're doing research for your stories.
And you have context.
I do,
you're doing the show, Stacey. You bring in context, as you just did to Leo 3 minutes ago.
Yeah.
So no, right. You're getting all that wrong because you have the experience and the context.
But here... And you're right. I've done this. This is why I talk to engineers more than I talk to people. Was wrong.
They're going to love hearing that construct.
Sorry,
yeah.
PR people is really like normal people who don't look at data, and that's
keep digging, Stacey. Keep digging.
I am more like that than an actual person, I guess. Anyway, the point is, engineers are my people because we think alike. We think in data, but I will tell you, as a journalist, fewer people read my stories because I don't have the narrative and I'm not very good at it. And that is the challenge. And I always call it the dead baby lead, because you lead with a dead baby to get your story, you know, out there. And Sarah Kiff is actually really good at this. She does healthcare data, for example, but she will always, all of her stories are super immersed in data, but they always have, they don't always have an actual dead baby, but they have some sort of, usually it's a dying patient of some sort. And but that type of journalism is really rare. It's really hard. It's really expensive. And people don't, I mean, and honestly, I don't think it actually drives page views, which is the advertising metric.
Let me argue with you, Stacey, because I think Leo's point is right. You're not giving yourself sufficient credit for the good job that you do in journalism. What I'm talking about here is that you come along. I mean, look at the red wine will kill you, red wine will save you stories, right? That's an example about how we just don't simply just understand and report on science the way it should be reported on. That there are strings of bits of research that test out various hypotheses and that add up to something, but the story doesn't add up to it. Or when we say, when there's this presumption that there's a filter bubble and it's never tested, that you do stories about, oh my God, we're all in a filter bubble. This is the roots of all of our problems in society right now. And then you have academic research at easy reach to just do a simple search to say, actually, no, the filter bubble's been debunked, but it's been debunked in a different world of the academe.
So I would say
that's the problem.
One, when people start talking about the filter bubble, we've been talking about the filter bubble before there was academic research about it. So people start estimating that this is out there. If you're actually at the cutting edge, people are estimating that these things happen, especially in the social sciences. And then the research comes out, either backs it up or doesn't back it up. So I think there's social science research is hard. And it's usually after the fact, after we've started writing articles about it. Empirical science that, you know, you can measure, even that is called into question. So those red wine studies are difficult because you'll have an article or you'll have a study come out one year that says this and then another one that says that. And I think another thing that's hard for journalists reporting on science is they don't understand science. They don't understand how studies should be written. And I think in like they don't understand the difference between a control group or maybe an overview study.
Which is my fault in journalism school that we don't teach them. Yeah, we got to do that. Let me give you a few facts from Bruns. Let me give you a few studies, let's say, right? So two studies looked at already divisive topics like abortion, vaccination, Obamacare, gun control, and found, of course, they're divisive online. Then they looked at other topics that people argue about, like Game of Thrones and food porn, and found that they didn't lead to polarization online. So is the problem that online creates the divisiveness, or that we just bring the divisiveness online? Another one, social media users, quoting here, generally encounter a greater diversity of news sources than non-users do. So that's the echo chamber argument. Oh, no, we're just in our filter bubble. We don't know crap. Another one, those users frequenting the most extremely partisan conservative sites in the United States have been found also to be more likely than ordinary internet users to visit the New York Times. Another one, exposure to highly partisan political information, I'm again quoting, does not come at the expense of contact with other viewpoints. These are things that are not hard to find. And I will confess here that I'm very ashamed of myself that I never learned, no one ever taught me in journalism school, no one ever taught me in a newsroom ever to go and do a search of academic research to find out what facts were. And yeah, we didn't have Google Scholar before, and we didn't have JSTOR, we didn't have other things. But I'm saying now that the next time I see a journalist do the lazy filter bubble story, I'm on their rear end.
I have to say, though, there's two things at work here. First of all, the reason people believe in the filter bubble is because it makes sense to them.
Yes.
So it's one of, and I think this we do this all the time. We don't look for studies or facts. It just, oh, that makes sense.
Same with the vaccination story.
It makes sense.
To some people, it makes sense.
Kind of makes sense. And then it's hard for a journalist because if you're constantly saying, well, wait a minute, but let's look at the facts. What makes sense to you is wrong. You end up sounding like, you're harping. I don't think you'll be a popular journalist for very long. And so this has to be done.
As Bernie Sanders would say,
Well, no, nobody likes Bernie either. I mean, that's a problem, and it's a problem. Journalists are, yes, of course, you know, it's a higher calling and all that, but ultimately, it's a business.
That doesn't
it's a
mean
profession,
that,
and
that
you
doesn't
need
mean
to,
you then say
you need
let's
to
go
build
with-
an audience, and if the audience gets angry because every time you come on, you say something that bursts their bubble.
So we should go with the falsity? Screw it?
Well,
no,
okay,
but you
well,
have to
I'm
do
just
it
gonna,
carefully.
Here's an easier reputation.
You can't do it every time. Okay.
As a journalist, as both a newsroom journalist who had only one story due every day, God, you remember being a daily journalist and people were like, that's so hard because you have to write a story every day.
Yeah, you could read the newspaper in the morning. It was amazing.
Oh, crazy. But now, and being a blogger who's had a story and even occasionally only having to do it one story a week, which is crazy. Academic papers suck. They're hard to read. They're hard to understand. They're expensive to find and access, even with things like Google Scholar.
And you can even find studies that completely contradict one another almost every time.
Yes, of course.
Yes. And in the world of academia, it's hard to know who's legit and who isn't. So I have to quote academic sources every now and then for some of my articles. Mm-hmm. And if you get the wrong academic, everyone else in the academic circles are laughing at you and they're like, and they'll come out of the woodworks. They're not just laughing at you. They're usually telling you what an idiot you are. And you also have to deal with people who think that their minor disagreements really matter when to the bigger picture and world at large, you're like, it doesn't.
True that.
So, and that's asking a lot of someone who's not paid very much and who is also trying to juggle a lot of other things.
But as a journalism teacher, I think that
well, you should always hold the highest standard.
Yeah,
and I'm realizing that I'm not, you know, yes, the head of research at our school teaches this, but I haven't been teaching this, and I need to.
Yeah, no, I think you're right.
Yeah,
I think you're right, but I think you also have to address the realpolitik of it all, which is you can't be the guy who's always bursting people's bubbles.
But you don't back up the bubble when the bubble is
don't
BS.
Back up the bubble.
Don't back up the bubble.
Don't back up the
bubble. That would be a show title, but we've far beat it.
Let's see. Let's take a break and come back with our change log. We've got picks of the week still to come as well. And we do want to wrap this up in the next 15 minutes.
No,
so
we're
that
fine. We're fine. We're fine.
You can get to the debate.
We're fine. We got a half an hour. We're okay.
Okay.
I know you're trying to get rid of me, but
I
you're
am.
Stuck with me. Yeah.
Our show today brought to you by Capterra. If you're in business, it's so common. It's almost universal. In fact, I just read a study we were talking about on Windows Weekly this morning. One third of all businesses are still running at least one Windows XP machine. Of course they are. And I can almost promise you the reason they run that Windows XP machine is because that critical, super important line of business program that they got written back in 1992 will only run on Windows XP, and they're stuck with it. That's why people still use Internet Explorer 8. Still use Flash, Active Desktop. But really, honestly, there is great software, modern software, better software out there if you could only find it. And that's why our sponsor really is helpful, Capterra. Capterra is the leading free online resource to help you find the best modern software for your business. And by the way, I think if you've done this, you know that, well, the first thought maybe is Google it. No, that's not, because that's just a bunch of results that are going to be all over the place. Ask a friend, but he is not going to know every. The Capterra is amazing. Capterra is a search engine, in effect, with 700 categories of business software and everything. I mean, from project management to email marketing, customer relation management, mailing list management, but also line of business software. Jail management software. You found a good one. You got to manage a jail? Jail tracker. Actually, it doesn't have to be jail tracker. Could be e-logger. Could be. Turns out there are half a dozen, maybe more, offender management system, jail management programs out there. Well, that's amazing. First, in custody. First of all, now we know there's some. But what's great is you can then narrow it down by the number of stars it's got, by how it delivers itself. Is it a local, you put it on your hard drive, or is it a, a web-based solution, how many seats it supports, whether, you know, it can make appointments, all the different features you might want. Narrow it down. You can compare side-by-side up to four, but then the best part, I'm kind of amazed that there's this many jail management programs out there. Then the best part is you can read the reviews. Almost a million verified real reviews by real users on Capterra.com. This is incredible. There's 1,000 new reviews every single day. So that means in the next, I don't know, 3 weeks, they're going to get over 1 million. And that's fantastic. That means you're not only going to find the right software, you're going to see what people who are using it right now say about it. Unbiased, real reviews from real people. This is such a great service. Capterra.com. Go there right now. Capterra.com/twig. To find the tools you need to make an informed decision, get the best software for your business, stop using Windows XP, start using something modern, and I got to say it again, it's kind of hard to believe, it's absolutely free. You know, the only thing I would say, if you do use some software, buy some software that or you know, install some software that you saw on Capterra, after you use it for a while, leave a review. Add to the valuable database that's Capterra.com. That's it. That's the only payment. And they don't even require that. Capterra.com/twig, the number one free resource for finding the software you need for your business. Capterra is software selection simplified. Capterra, Capterra.com/twig. Please use that address because then they'll know you saw it here. And then we get credit for that. And we thank you, Capterra, for being such a great supporter of This Week in Google. Are you excited? Are you interested in this T-Mobile Sprint merger? It looks like it might be going forward. There's still a few hurdles, but
why not?
I think what's really interesting, and I mentioned this on Twitter, is Charlie Ergen.
He
is quite
that
a
was
character.
A conspiratorial.
He's the founder of Dish. Dish is the big beneficiary on this because Dish. So Charlie is a very interesting fella. A great profile about him in the Wall Street Journal. I've met Charlie. I've done his show, Charlie Chat, on Dish. He was a professional poker player for many years, then an analyst at Frito-Lay. He decided to quit his job at Frito-Lay, joined with another poker player friend. They ponied up $60,000 to start a business selling big satellite dishes, the 10-meter dishes in Denver. Eventually, he founded the Dish Network, selling those hubcap-sized dishes, going right up against the cable TV business and winning. That $60,000 investment is now worth $9 billion. That's his stake in the Dish Network. One thing Charlie's been doing, so he's a really interesting fella. He's kind of a character. But one thing he's been doing is buying up Spectrum and not using it. Much to the dismay of T-Mobile, Sprint, AT&T, Verizon, and the FCC, he's been collecting Spectrum.
He has been the biggest Spectrum speculator out there for the longest time and one of the more litigious.
Yeah. He's buying it, holding on to it, and it sits there as a dead asset.
Yes, although he would argue that he is using it, or he has always had plans to use it, and various things keep getting in the way.
Knew that Dish was going to do this at some point, right?
Yes. And, you know, he's in a really interesting space because right now with 5G, so having access to both dishes on people's homes and millimeter wave spectrum, which he has, he can actually build a viable network, which is, I mean, this is exactly how AT&T and Verizon, or how Verizon specifically, is doing their 5G to the home network.
But even better, and he even says this in this Wall Street Journal piece, he said, why would I build LTE, just have to rip it out when 5G comes along? He's been thinking all along, I'll start with 5G.
I think he's actually been, he's had the spectrum, and he's made some interesting spectrum trades over the years, too. I think he's positioning to be in a space where he can actually offer a compelling service to compete with these guys, where he doesn't have to compete against their spectrum holdings, which have been superior historically. He's also doing an NB-IoT network.
What's that?
NB-IoT, it's a cellular standard that sends very tiny bits of data out, and you can, it's just tiny bits of data.
Microchip Bluetooth Internet of Things. So So a couple of things I think are interesting. Yes, he may have just been, he may come out as one of, as like, he was accidentally smart, right? It may be he didn't have this strategy.
No, no,
he
I think he was very, very
I think
smart.
He knew what he was doing, but you can't
be
sure.
Yeah, I think he was very smart.
I think he reminds me a little of Elon Musk, maybe Jeff Bezos, as one of those guys who's willing to take the long shot. I think this. I think he's a he's
Malone
a poker
too.
Player. Yeah. He's pushed
all
his
these
chips.
Cable guys are poker players.
They're poker players, and I think he knew he was taking a big risk.
So
he's taking a huge
yet?
Risk. They say he says it's going to cost him $10 billion to build this network. This is not.
Did you explain yet how this comes out of the Verizon deal? What he gets out
of the Sprint T-Mobile? Yes. Yeah. So in order to this, so this is what's fascinating, and this is from the Wall Street Journal piece. He's sitting there. Sitting on all these assets, just sitting. And all of a sudden, John Ledger at T-Mobile is told by the Department of Justice, we're not going to let this go through unless you can somehow figure out a way to create a credible fourth carrier. John Ledger goes, how am I going to do that? Thinks of Charlie. He says, he calls up Charlie within, they made this deal in 3 weeks.
Wow.
And yeah. Charlie's going to get Sprint PCS MVNO business, which is Metro PCS. He's going to get T-Mobile's Boost, another MVNO style, although it's owned by those companies. So part of the reason he needs that is because he has a deal that he has to be up and running as a wireless carrier by next year. So he is.
Whoa.
They just give him these businesses.
Yep.
It may not be a very good business. It may not be a very big business, but he's satisfied the requirement. And so that gives him a little breathing room so that he can then start building this $10 billion 5G network. You know what? He could fail miserably. He knows he could fail miserably. This could be a huge gamble, and he pushes in all his chips and he has to walk
away
from the
table. So what else did he get from T-Mobile?
He got a lot of spectrum, but I don't know if it's valuable spectrum. Maybe Stacy knows that better than I do.
I'm looking at their current current spectrum holdings before the acquisition. I can go look. I haven't seen their...
Essentially, this was mandated by the Department of Justice. They said, look, you've got, in order to approve this merger, you've got to create a credible fourth carrier. And this was actually a very clever way to do it. Under the merger, Dish will rent capacity from T-Mobile, from the new T-Mobile, which is the combined.
Which, by the way, is run by whom? By
T-Mobile.
No, by which CEO?
Ledger.
Ledger, good.
Yeah, Sprint's out of the... Now, I don't know what happens to SoftBank's investment in Sprint. I guess they probably still have a piece of the combined companies. Right. Deutsche Telekom owns a big piece of, if not all, of T-Mobile. So these are actually... Don't think, even though these companies were struggling, especially Sprint, that they are not well-funded. They've got SoftBank behind them.
Right.
They've got Deutsche Telekom. After 7 years of using T-Mobile's capacity, Dish will now run its own network using all that spectrum he's been acquiring and its own equipment installed on fewer towers. So it's a very interesting play. I think, Charlie, I love watching people like Elon Musk, as crazy as they are, because they're willing to play at a level, a Wild West level, mm-hmm. that most corporate CEOs in America just aren't willing to do. And it's, and you know what? Elon wants to put 12,000 low Earth orbit satellites up to create global internet at gigabit internet.
I also love it when the third point, when Ledger goes after his competitors and pokes them.
Well, and that's so why we needed somebody, because yes. Charlie's the new John Ledger. So
right.
If it weren't for T-Mobile, I don't think we'd have the deals we have from Verizon and yes. AT&T by any means.
Yeah. So, okay. So it's actually... Dish is actually going to get part of Sprint's 800 megahertz spectrum, which
that's
is
juicy,
awesome.
Juicy.
And
yeah.
Dish already has 600 and 700 megahertz spectrum.
Yeah.
So they have really, I mean, so who cares about 5G and their stupid millimeter wave? It's got stuff that is going to.
Yeah, these relatively low frequencies go through walls. And that's really what's key. These are the old TV spectrum. That remember yes. that when the digital moved to digital, they had to give up those 700 megahertz spectrum. That's what he has. So that is, yeah, that's going to be a better cell phone service than these other guys can offer.
Is it cell phone or is it data or what?
Well,
is
it's
it?
All. I doubt they're very
That'll
much.
That'll be data.
It'll all be data. They're not going to do.
Well, but okay, so he can't do massive amounts of data because I think he's only got a 20 megahertz total in that band, which in your, so the width of your channels is what allows you, what is the limiting factor on how many bits per hertz you can.
Well, and the other thing Charlie's betting on is that, remember we were talking about how hard these giant corporate mergers are when you have two different cultures, you have two different technologies. Mm-hmm. I think he's betting that T-Mobile is going to be struggling integrating Sprint's customers, Sprint's network into their network.
Stores.
It's the store. It's going to be a mess. And I think he's saying to himself, that gives me a decade to build out something better. He also says he wants to disintermediate the phone companies. He says, you know, he says that their networks.
Yeah, everybody wants to disintermediate the phone companies.
Well, of course. but he's in that business now. He says he's starting from behind in the cell phone game, but he argues it gives him an advantage. Their legacy is a mishmash. Their networks are plaid. We will be a solid color. You got to like this guy. He also says he sees some opportunity with car companies offering 5G self-driving cars. He's going to target those businesses.
Does this affect his core dish business?
Pardon me?
Does it affect his core dish business? Does he deliver?
I think it integrates with his core business, right? Those dishes can be used. Can they be used? Are they the right frequencies?
You don't need to. So your satellite dishes, if given the spectrum he owns, he doesn't need to worry about that.
Okay. He doesn't need
to. So he'll be
like
fine
that.
He also have to have space on towers, which.
That's going to be tricky, right? That's where the $10 billion comes in, I would imagine. He also says he wants to offer something called on-demand pricing, charging less in the middle of the night. I think what Charlie's looking at is B2B. Business, not so much the consumer business of B2B.
And there's a whole, so Dish and Twilio and, oh gosh, even Arm is getting into this. There is a whole business right now to be had in saying, I'm going to give you internet access for your things. Again, it's IoT.
Right.
And it's because a company like BMW, for example, doesn't want to have to do deals with AT&T and Verizon and Deutsche Telekom and everybody. They want one throat to choke, basically. And they want to have SLAs that work for them when they're talking to their customer.
Yeah.
And it's going to be a huge business. The carriers know it. Everybody knows it. Everybody's trying really hard. And we'll see who wins.
It's just a fascinating story. Great piece in the Wall Street Journal about Charlie Ergen. And I think we're going to have a lot of fun over the next decade watching this play out. Now, is this bad for consumers? Losing combining two into one?
Yes. Yes, because T-Mobile has gotten better. Sprint has kind of failed.
I feel like we would have lost Sprint anyway.
Kind of have. I mean, who's on Sprint today?
Right. I feel like them together will be better at fighting AT&T and Verizon.
That's kind of my thought.
Than they were apart.
That's why I've been rooting for this merger. And even if their service is very good, as Ledger did before, they'll poke them so hard that we'll get better deals.
Right. I'm a T-Mobile fan. I've been a John Ledger fan. And I also think that Charlie wants to take over the role of the industry iconoclast and the poker. Mm-hmm. And I think Charlie's a really good person to do that.
He'll be the Craig McCaw of this decade?
Yeah. Craig McCaw's a great analogy. He was the guy who created the cell phone business, basically.
Wireless, I think one of my first stories for GigaOM was actually like, to be in wireless, you need to be...
ballsy. It's crazy.
Because it is
crazy
a
crazy business.
So.
Yep.
Yep.
We'll watch. It's not over. There are I think, a dozen state attorneys general who are still suing, saying it's anti-competitive. I wonder if those lawsuits will disappear now that the DOJ has said, well, we think it's competitive if they do this, this, and this. So, interesting. Let's do that thing with the trumpets and the drums. It's time for the Google changelog.
A Google changelog.
Wait, so Karsten has to hit like four buttons to make that happen?
Yeah, it's very complicated. There's a steam engine involved. He's got a.
Is there not a macro we can have for that?
Wow. No, that macro is named Karsten.
We probably could automate it, but I don't. I like watching him scramble.
It was a scramble.
You finally got to see
I enjoy that too.
It's like an octopus. It's like, I didn't think you did the
No, he's actually using gesture control.
That's what we need. Only. We need gesture control.
All right, so we need a way to punch Leo, and we need a way to make Karsten's life less miserable. All right.
You've got me here today.
Uh-oh.
Oh.
So that means you got to be nice to me.
Have you had any reason to want to punch me to this point?
Not today.
Thank goodness, sweetie.
Like,
Well, he punches good. Google Chrome 76 is here, and it does a number of interesting things, including block Flash. It also has an interesting feature that paywalls won't like. It turns out in Chrome, you know, they have this incognito mode, but a lot of sites have figured out a way to bypass incognito
or to recognize you're in incognito and then come after you and say
you can't. Yeah, there are a number of sites that will say no incognito visits because we don't get any information about you. So Google has reestablished the power of the incognito mode.
We go back to Flash for a second. So when I try to watch MSNBC, I've got to go through this whole Megillah every time where I have to say it's okay to do Flash like three times.
MSNBC uses Flash? Okay, well, they need to fix that. That's really what this will do.
That's what I'm hoping for.
Nobody will be able to see it. I mean, Flash...
Ironically, though, when I want to do Google Hangouts, if I want to take a picture of me, I have to enable Flash.
Really?
Which is... Yeah, so like... You know how, and maybe this won't happen for much longer, but there's an option for you to take a picture of what you're doing right now.
Look at this on MSNBC. No flash detected. Adobe Flash is required to watch our live video. Please visit Adobe.com to activate Adobe Flash in 5 easy steps.
Which never
5 easy steps. And by the way, I'm on a Chromebook, so it won't work.
It won't work. Right. And so then it tries to go in here and tell me to do it there. Then I've got to do it
up
here.
So that's just ridiculous. It's ridiculous. There's absolutely no reason in this day and age why any website should be streaming via Flash.
Did you hear that? I know you're watching. Did you hear that?
But why does Google use it for Hangouts? Go to Google Hangouts and click the little attach a photo thing. And if you use your web camera, boom.
Really?
You get the same message. Yeah. I'm looking at it right now.
That's weird.
Just to make sure.
Huh. Don't know.
Google
better fix that, Google.
Different teams, but still, I'm like, it's so baffling. Okay, sorry.
I don't know anything about that. The reason you might want to use incognito mode is to bypass that counter that says you've already had your 5 free. And so if they're not saving a cookie, they wouldn't know that.
Which, by the way, the counters lie regularly. There are sites that I have never gone to in life. You go to and it says, oh, you've already seen your 3 articles.
It works, though, because I've ended up paying for Bloomberg, which I really didn't want to do because that's $35 a month. I've ended up paying for Wired. Ooh. I was willing to do
$35 that. Bucks a month?
Bloomberg really rakes you over the coals. But, I mean, it's a business expense. It's a necessity. And so, you know, I do it. But, geez, I hate – if every website charged $35 a month, I'd be broke. I mean, we use so many different websites. Anyway, Google has fixed that incognito mode.
How do you define fix, Mr. President?
Now you can go to the Boston Globe or the New York Times and read as many articles as you want.
Basically, it doesn't tell people you're using incognito.
That was the problem, and it's been doing that for years. And so stop it, Google. You know, I will show you another a useful tip if you want to know a useful tip. Remember I was talking last week or 2 weeks ago about using startpage.com. If you on the start page site, I'm going to go search for New York Times. Remember, these are Google search results. So it's going to give me the same results I would get on every link. And I should have mentioned this. There is every search result. Whoa. There's an anonymous view. If I click that, it goes through a kind of a Tor style anonymizer. That means it's all reset. So I don't use this because I pay for the New York Times. I don't use this to bypass, you know, any paywalls. But it does. That is a very nice way if you want to go to a site and not have them know anything about you. Actually, I can demonstrate that.
By the way, that's the creepiest technology story.
Oh, the Epstein story. He wanted to freeze his head in his
He wanted to spread his DNA through mankind.
He wanted to impregnate 20 women with his sperm and host them at a ranch.
Insane. I'm going back to the changelog.
My fault.
Anyway, I'll show you. If I go right now to a site like whore.net, which tells you what your IP address is, what your browser is, who your ISP is. If I do that from the start page search, it knows a lot of stuff about me. But if I click the anonymous view from here, it's like Tor. It thinks I'm from some other spot. It thinks I'm in West Hills, United States, using Hurricane Electric. I'm on Linux. I'm not.
Jeez.
So this is really a useful tool for completely anonymizing yourself, better than incognito mode if you want to go to a site and you want to go.
You've just bankrupted the news business. Thank you very much.
You're very welcome.
Hurricane Electric is a hot potato routing site, so it's not an actual ISP. But if you wanted to, you could look at that and say, oh, they're using Hurricane Electric. That's not legit.
Don't let them in. Yeah, I guess they can.
Yeah.
Well, when they do that, we'll do something else. If you are interested in Google's Titan security keys, I honestly think there are other solutions just as good. I'm a YubiKey fan. But if you want to get your security keys from Google, you can now, not only in the U.S., but in Canada, Japan, France, and the U.K. And I guess because it's from Google and all of that. But you can use Google's super security system without having their particular keys. They had problems with the Titan security keys, so I'm not a huge... Now, what are you saying?
I saw the next story.
Android Auto's first big refresh since debuting is starting to roll out with Jeff Jarvis's very favorite feature, dark mode. Now, dark mode...
By default!
But it's good in your car.
No, it's not!
It's so much better in your car.
You don't want
a
bright...
No, it's not! I'm going over the bridge and I'm in a panic because it's all dark.
No, but it's... You're going actually, over the bridge at night and you can't see anything.
Well, actually, I turn
so
it off.
In your car.
You want the truth? I turn off Waze when going over the bridge because I don't want to see all the blue.
The blue, the water around
it.
Yeah. This is a redesigned Android Auto. I do not have a car with Android Auto. I wish I... Actually, I do, but I don't get to drive it. That's the Chevy Bolt. As I was saying earlier, I still drive a car from, 2016. It feels so antiquated. It's funny how technologies move so fast that a car's... informatics from 2015 or 2016 seems out of date, but it does. I wish I had Android Auto.
And think about it this way: the car that is being sold today, their informatics were developed and built and implemented in like 2015.
Yeah, that's why.
Ridiculous.
Yeah, that's
it's
why.
Not I mean,
there's no
Tesla's pretty good.
Modular.
You have a Tesla, Stacy. That's they've done a good job of keeping it up to date. That's you know, I gave up my Tesla. The lease ran out, so that's why I'm kind of suffering.
Yeah, I came in the parking lot here, and I thought, oh, no, Leo's not here.
Oh, yeah.
And then I realized.
I'll look for my car. So I love this story from The Information. Google has many OEM partners for its smart speakers. One of them was Huawei. They were going to do a speaker that would come out this fall at the IFA trade show in Berlin.
A smart speaker that's listening to you all the time.
Yeah, actually, in a way, that's kind of probably a good idea not to do a Huawei Google smart speaker. When can we get the new Nest Hub Max? I want to get that.
September 9th. That's when you can order it.
Yeah.
I don't know if it's going to ship the same day.
I
want to
get that. I like the looks of that.
Aren't you going to wait for the one with Project Soli in it?
Oh, will there be? I guess there would. Then
well,
it could,
if you believe me, then
it could
then
see
yes.
everything in 3D.
Then it could read your gestures.
I had that. Remember the advertiser that had the what was it? Lighthouse had the 3D
time of flight sensor
in it and all that stuff. So I'm not, I'm not shy. I don't mind.
Well, that was an actual camera.
Yeah,
and the
time of flight sensor.
So you couldn't fool the camera with weird like cutouts of people moving around.
Yeah, actually, it was pretty cool.
Didn't you fool it with a balloon, though?
No, that was the one that didn't get fooled by the balloon.
Okay.
The Nest IQ, which is now here, got fooled by the balloon. It kept saying, there's somebody in your house. It was Mylar balloons. Google is phasing out the old voice search.
The old voice search getting phased out in favor of the new young assistant.
Okay, fine.
What's the difference to a consumer?
Not much. It looks different.
Oh, then never mind.
No, it doesn't. It's the same response, you know. I have John Legend now on all my Google Assistant stuff. I love it. I love it.
I have Cyan, I believe is the color.
Oh, you use Cyan? I like Cyan a lot, yeah. They do it by color, the voices now. That's a good tip, by the way. I think we've mentioned it before, but go into your settings and choose a color. There are some very dramatic differences. And that, watch this now, watch Karsten. And that's the Google changelog. Oh, he was on it.
Oh, he cheated.
He was ready. Let's do the Google changelog again.
Jeff Jarvis. Oh, Jeff. Jeff used to be the critic for TV Guide.
Now he's
you don't use
lying
my
on the highway.
Lower thirds, that's what happens.
He used to be the critic for TV Guide. So did Howard Stern pick up on that, former TV Guide critic, lower third?
No. All right. That's how he knows me, because
that's
I wrote
how he
about
knows you. Yeah. Ah. Oh, that's how that all started?
Yeah. Yeah, I gave him a good review, and he offered to do unspeakable things to me.
Jeff has been a former TV Guide critic for a long time.
A very long time. Long time. Spotify's doing well. 108 million paying customers. Total monthly active user count, 232 million. Yeah. Yeah, for a while it looked like Apple Music was coming on strong, might beat Spotify. In fact, the Wall Street Journal said it's just a matter of time. Nope. Apple Music is not even close.
I am weird because I live La Vida Google. I still use Google Play Music.
It's fine.
What am I missing?
Nothing. In fact, I'm mad at myself because I went through a pruning and I thought, well, I've got Apple Music, I've got Amazon Music, and I've got Google Music. I only need one of those. I'm going to keep Apple Music. I killed Google Music, and I forgot that also was giving me YouTube Red.
Right.
Or YouTube Premium, as they call it now. All of a sudden, I got all these ads in my YouTube.
Oh, that is
worth the price of admission alone.
Yeah.
So that's what you're missing.
So you can watch great elephant videos.
I don't know what that's about.
Cute elephants.
You can still watch cute elephants with ads.
Yeah. I have ads now. I think it was funny because our teenager noticed. He said, why am I seeing all these ads on my YouTube all of a sudden? I went, oh, shoot.
My daughter, we have Hulu because we got a special, a while back for 99 cents a month.
Oh, nice.
And it's the ad version, but I'm like 99 cents a month. I'm okay with it.
Yeah.
She's like, what are these ads? They're stupid. And I'm like, oh, yeah, ads are really bad.
She has not seen commercial television, has she?
She is. I mean,
why do they keep playing the same ad, Mommy?
Yeah, she's like these, like the Liberty Mutual ones.
Oh, God, I hate that emu. That freaking emu. That's the worst.
Oh, I do, too.
The lemu.
I do, too. And you know what? I actually looked up. I was worried that there was animal abuse.
No, it's a CGI.
They say it's animatronic, yeah.
It's a CGI emu. But you can't get a real emu to peck the glass over and over again. Come on, man.
I was worried.
It's so
insurance companies are
it
evil.
It feels like Liberty Mutual wants to be Geico, but can't. They need a better agency. That's all I'm saying. Anyway.
And there can only be one Geico.
There can only be
What's
one.
What's his name? Chuck?
Chuck?
Not the emu, but the guy. The guy.
Yeah. Oh. Lemu and Chuck. Terrible.
It's awful.
70s cop show parody that just doesn't ring true at all. And then there's Captain Obvious. Has Hulu stopped with that? Because they were running a Captain Obvious ad every break. Every break for hotels.com. It was getting so tiring. They need to sell more ads, that's all.
I'm a Fios.
We may be in a different...
Sorry.
Oh, go on.
YouTube Premium is $11.99 a month. I am such an idiot. I canceled... Because I was grandfathered in at the $8 a month for YouTube Music.
See,
Google
this is
Music.
What you get for all this giving things
I'm
up.
Such
and
an
I'm going to quit. I'm finished.
What was I thinking?
Yeah, well, you see what you do to yourself. See,
I wonder if I can go back. I wonder if I say,
Google,
"Hey, I'm
will
sorry.
You forgive me?
Please forgive me, you Google." Wouldn't that would be nice if they have said, "Well, yeah, okay, you can get back in at your grandfathered."
Yeah, price. That's not going to happen.
No. They've been just waiting for me, right?
Like, I'm sorry, Leo.
Waiting for me to do that. Subscribe. Let me just see how much it costs. Because don't you still get YouTube Premium when you subscribe to Google Music?
I think so, yeah.
Yeah.
Or vice versa. Depends on how you look at it.
I should probably just resubscribe. It's $15 a month now for the family plan.
Well, I like Google Music.
Ladies and gentlemen, I think we should wrap this up. I think we've gone through... Do you have a story I've missed?
I was just going to ask about the FI limits, which some people have brought up because they're upset.
Are there limits on your FI? You
can only have 4 SIMs now, not...
Data SIMs.
Data SIMs.
Oh, that's too bad because I was about to order another data SIM. I love the... I have dozens of them. Because you only pay for what you use. It does affect me.
That's what people are doing.
It only pays for what you use, so I was putting SIMs in everything.
Right.
My car, everything.
I wish I could put it in a Chromebook, yeah.
Oh, well.
One day, Jeff.
One day.
All right.
It's time for Stacy and her pick of the week. And I bet you I know what it's going to be. Is it going to be the Wyze smart plugs?
You know, someone asked me about that. I can make those my pick of the week. I had something different.
They've announced the pricing and pre-orders.
Yeah, I have here. Let me pull up the thing.
$15 a pair. That's is amazing. I'm going to make that my pick.
All right, you do it. I can't bring myself to buy more smart plugs. I have so many.
You only need as many smart plugs as you have sockets.
That is not true. But you can more? Still wait, buy wait. Them.
What would you do with more than you have sockets?
Sorry, I mean, I don't need that many because not all of my sockets are.
Oh, full. You need fewer than.
Are homes being built with smart plugs?
They should be.
In every.
No, but homes are being built with USB
ports. I'm seeing that.
Yeah, I've seen that, right.
Because that's a cheap and easy.
Well, I saw somebody on Twitter today, a friend of mine, said that he could tell from the fresh paint smell he was in a new room, and then he saw that the USB port in the wall was USB-C.
Ooh, that's modern.
That is this year.
Living in the future.
That's so 2019.
Oh, my God, I want... All right, so we won't mention the Wyze smart plugs. What is your pick?
My pick of the week, and I've mentioned this before. I think I just shut down that window, though, so let me go get to it. Slate does a deal with Future Tense, and they have people write fiction stories.
Yeah.
And they're awesome fiction stories, and they're all about, like, extravagant. It's like Black Mirror, but they're not all depressing, right? And so they're putting them all in an anthology. And, yes, you can read all of them online for free on Slate.
Nice.
But if you're just the type of person who just wants to have it, you know, in a book or Kindle format, it won't be available till October 2nd, but you can pre-order it now. I love this. My favorite story probably of all of them is Charlie Jane Anders had this awesome one. I even wrote a response to one of them. So that's my pick of the week. You should totally read these. They're fun. You'll enjoy them.
Nice. I love sci-fi. I did not know that you were a sci-fi fan, however.
I'm a reading fan.
Reading.
I read everything. Mm. I read cereal boxes.
Mm. You know what? I'm on a James McWhorter pick.
Because of you. Yeah.
Turns out, so you talked about his book about the English
language. The bastard language.
Our bastard tongue. But it turns out, remember I was telling you about the great courses I was listening to? That's him.
Yeah.
It's his great course. And then he has another book, which I found in my searches, about Black English, which is really good.
Oh.
Really good. It's only a few hours. It's a shorter book. But he talks about how it is a full-fledged language. Yes. A lot of people think it's a form of illiteracy or it's slangy. Oh. It's not. It's a full-fledged language with its own grammar and its syntax. And it's really quite interesting. It's quite fascinating. So highly recommend that as well. James McWhorter. He is a linguist.
Yes, he's phenomenal. He's
but great. What is your number, Mr. Jarvis?
So the LA Times today had a memo leaked, perhaps, about how their efforts to get subscriptions are not going so well. Their goal was to get 300,000 new subscriptions this year. They have 17,000.
Oh, dear.
They got more than that, but a lot of people are canceling.
You know, the Times, I almost knew this because they were one of the only daily papers to show up in Apple's News Plus product.
Yeah, they said, what the heck?
The Wall Street Journal didn't do it. The New York Times didn't do it. The Washington Post didn't do it. And I think because all three of them have fairly robust digital subscription numbers, And I kind of read that as the Times is a little bit desperate.
So Josh Benton from Neiman Lab did a great post. If you go to the second chart here, Leo, the next one. He looked at 2002 print circulation versus 2019 digital subs. There are two publications where the digital subs are higher than the print
look
was.
At that.
New York Times in 2002 had 1.1 million print. Now it has 2.7 million digital.
So digital's been good for the Times.
Washington Post, 746,000 print in 2002, now 1.7 million. All the other papers have far fewer.
But I'll tell you why. I think print. The Times, New York Times, and the Washington Post are seen as national newspapers.
Exactly. The LA Times, again, wants to fool itself and think that
like
it's
a
national,
local paper.
But it's a great metro paper.
Yeah.
So it now had 965,000, almost a million print circulation in 2002. Now it has 170,000 digital subs. And they want to try to get up to a million. Who knows?
Yeah.
The Chronicle, San Francisco Chronicle, had 512,000 print. Now it has 57,000 digital.
I think it just bodes poorly for metro papers.
Paywalls at that level are hard to justify. Yeah. A lot of churn. So yeah, the internet's ruined something else.
Lavender Fields and Metro Dailies.
Yeah.
Do we? All right. Here's a question for the journalists in the house. Do we need Metro Dailies, or is it sufficient to have nationals?
Oh, no, we need local.
You not only need Metro, you need towns. Super city
Small
council
town
people.
Papers. Yeah, we have the Argus Courier in Petaluma.
So
they cover the city council. You're right.
My dean, Sarah Bartlett, was core in helping to start The City in New York, which is the Texas Tribune of New York. Texas Tribune, which was founded by, I dare say the name again, John Thornton.
He didn't found it. He just funded it, but yes.
Yeah, anyway. But it set a model for nonprofit journalism in the country. But that's not going to solve every problem.
No.
There's not enough charity. There's not enough
patronage.
But things like The City and the Texas Tribune give their content for free to media around them, so it helps bolster the journalism in the ecosystem. So that's another model that's starting up. You look at something like Medium. I think I figured out what he's doing. He's trying to create kind of the YouTube of text.
The YouTube of text.
You think about that in a way. I know.
There's a difference because he's charging subscriptions and he's pushing. I have to say, I'm a little irritated with Medium because every time I go there, it says, oh, you could read more if you would just pay
for
it.
But it's only $5 a month as opposed to
Bloomberg. I canceled my $5 a month.
Well, and
I don't like
it
the
also
dark patterns.
It pushes content that is old. Right. Yeah. That's what drives me nuts.
That's part of his argument, Stacey, and I don't know that I agree with it because I find it a little irritating sometimes too, but his argument is that the rabid currency of the web is what led to a lot of our problems. So that he wants to, when Medium started, he didn't put a date on the page. There was no date there, which was irritated people. Mm-hmm. But now he will surface stuff from the past, and I will find things I wrote a year ago will suddenly get a comment or something. It's kind of interesting to see how that happens.
Actually, that reminds me of a story we didn't do, which is the guy who invented retweeting. He says, we handed a loaded weapon to four-year-olds.
I thought I was going to make it safely out of here before. World panic!
Well, I have to admit, retweeting is one of the things that makes Twitter...
No, it also brings
so
magnificent
knee-jerk.
Things. It's great. This is pandering to...
I do like the heroic pictures of him.
Yeah, geez. I mean,
Chris Weatherall, who no longer
he's
works
staring at a
Twitter.
Burning bush.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, pissed me off.
Okay, well, I'm glad I brought it up then.
Yeah, thanks.
I kind of live to piss you off,
might,
Jeff.
I just hope I don't crash on the bridge.
No, you won't. Don't think of that.
I finally figured it out. I hope. My palms are sweating, literally, at the mention of it. But I try to not know where I am. I concentrate on the car ahead.
Oh, I discovered that years ago.
And then I sing a song.
I have no idea where I am.
Jeff, are you driving yourself or do you get a car?
I can't afford a chauffeur.
We would pay for a car for
you.
No,
I drive it myself. I have one.
Oh, okay. No, I was the way you were.
I'll give you a chit.
Well, I have the car in the lot. So if you'll drive that. Karsten, can you drive the car to the city?
Yes, he could do that.
Sure. would be fun.
Next time, would you please let us send a car for you?
Fine,
would that be a better way for you to come?
No, I'm fine. It's embarrassing. It's embarrassing.
It's not embarrassing.
I can pick you up.
Oh, I don't know if I trust that.
Yeah, I wouldn't take a ride from Karsten if I were you.
He's driving with the hand gestures. And the
what? Where's my horn? Where's my horn? I need the horn.
Beep, beep. Where's my horn?
Jeff Jarvis is a professor of journalism. Well, he's not just a professor of journalism. He's the Leonard Tow Professor for Journalistic Innovation at the Craig Newmark Graduate School of Journalism.
Breath.
At the City University of New York. And is a blogger, prolific at buzzmachine.com, and a book author, prolific, now in paperback, What Would Google Do? Public Parts.
Long ago.
Paper. I said that on your blog, that's why I said it. Now in paperback, Gutenberg the Geek, Geeks Bearing Gifts, and lots more. Read his books. They're good. We also thank Stacy Higginbotham. Stacy on IoT is her website, stacyoniot.com, her great newsletter there. Read that. Subscribe to that. It's free. Why wouldn't you? And, of course, the IoT podcast with Kevin Toefel, a must listen at Giga Stacy on the tweet storm, on the retweet machine. Do you hit the retweet button, Stacy?
I'm pro-retweeting. It hadn't occurred to me that people are using it for abuse, but once it did, I was like, I tried to become more judicious about how I used it.
Actually, the president used it just
people
this,
use
just
ice
today.
Cream for abuse. They use just, everything for
just
abuse.
Just today, the president retweeted a QAnon site, brought it to Twitter's attention, they banned the site. So be careful out there. You never know what a retweet will do. We do Twig every Wednesday, about 1:30 Pacific, 4:30 Eastern, 20:30 UTC. You could watch live if you wanted, or listen live. We have live audio and video streams at twit.tv/live. If you're doing that, join us in the chat room, irc.twit.tv. We don't get a lot of in-studio visitors because it's the middle of the week, I guess, but you're always welcome. If you're going to be in the Petaluma area, send us an email, tickets@twit.tv. And say which shows you'd like to attend, and we'll let you know if we're doing those shows and if the studio is open. It's not always open, but it's open for this show every week. And we'd love to have you. We'll put a chair out for you and all of that. If you want to download copies of the show, we also make those available on demand because it's a podcast, after all, and that's the whole idea there. Just go to twit.tv/twig. What is that sound? Is there somebody grinding stumps in your backyard, Stacy?
Oh, no, that is someone, I guess, taking a shower right next door to me. So now we know what it sounds like in my little area when someone takes a shower next door.
Okay, it's good to know. Good to know.
Sorry.
It sounds a little bit like a stump grinder. I have it turned up too loud, obviously. What was I saying? Oh, subscribe. That's the best thing to do, because that way you'll get the show the minute it's available. Thank you all for watching, listening, and for being here. We'll see you next time on Twig.